For every new regulation his administration issues, President Trump has said two regulations have to be eliminated. But what about the ordinary Americans many of these regulations were designed to protect? Are we heading back to the days of predatory lenders? Today we sit down with the New York Times financial journalist to try to make sense of the financial stories affecting Americans everywhere. He's Michael Corkery, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and colleague G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week we try to shine some light on the story shaping public discussion of important issues and the policies that result. This week we're joined by Michael Corkery, an award-winning financial journalist with the New York Times, whose reporting often explores the impact of big money and big corporations on the lives of normal people. In 2016, he and two of his Times colleagues were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for a series on corporations stripping consumers of their right to sue for unfair business practices. Michael, it's great to have you with us today.
Thanks, Jim.
You dig into some of the arcane features of big business, the role of finance, and you expose how these wealthy entities operate, often at the expense of the little guy, to put it politely. Why is this relevant today?
Well, I think it's gotten, it's sort of always been relevant. It's gotten even more relevant, I think, in today's climate. I mean, I think a lot of us, after the election and Trump's election to the presidency, were somewhat shocked at the depth of the anger and unhappiness in the country. I was certainly shocked by it, but I, you know, as a financial journalist that have tried to focus my beat on just how corporations are treating, you know, average Americans, mm-hmm. it's an unfair place. And, you know, you can go as far back as you want, but over the past decade, you know, with the mortgage crisis on up through the sort of shrinking economy and, you know, jobs not being what they used to be, it's a place that it really feels like the system is stacked against you. And that's what I've kind of tried to focus on is corporations and big companies and banks and their role in that.
Well, so the system is stacked against the little guy. So, you know, back to the earliest days of the progressive movement in the United States, people like Teddy Roosevelt tried to use the federal government to sort of tip that scale a little bit, to put regulation and rules in that would protect individuals, protect the citizen, protect the consumer. President Trump, in his first 6 weeks in office, has said, we're going to eliminate regulation. We want to go back to some of the practices that led to the mortgage crisis in the first decade of the 21st century. What is the prospect for protecting? Is journalism the last readout of protection for the individual consumer?
Well, if you listen to Trump's chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, I mean, the media is the opposition party.
The enemy of the people.
The enemy of the people, Trump himself has said. It certainly feels that way. I mean, if you, for a man who rode into the White House, you know, fueled by this populist anger and this feeling that the world is stacked against him by the rich guys, he's put an awful lot of rich guys in his cabinet. And these are the—
Not just rich guys, billionaires.
Billionaires. Very rich guys. And these are the financiers that have been able to make their fortune off of many of the same policies that has fueled so much anger. I mean, we had a story in our paper in the Times this Sunday about Wilbur Ross, the new Commerce Secretary. I mean, he's somebody that says we need to renegotiate our trade deals, and yet he is, you know, his fortune, and at least in one of his investments, was very much benefited by NAFTA and his deals in Mexico. So it's ironic, I guess, that this is who he's stacked his cabinet with. It's hard to know where it's going to go in terms of policy, but it doesn't augur well for more regulation mm-hmm. that would benefit these very people that put him there.
This is a really big theme and a really large canvas. So as a financial writer with a lot of expertise and awards and knowledge, it would seem that you would have your pick of topics. I mean, there would be like endless topics. How do you decide, you and your editors, and walk us through, how do you decide what to focus on? I know you spend a lot of time on stories, so it's not like you're going to pick something out of a pile and 2 days later pick something else. How do you decide where and why to invest your personal resources in the papers?
So that's a good question. I think, I mean, like Wayne, you know this better than anyone. And sometimes it is the story of the day, or it's a sort of luck, or I mean, that's the beauty of being a newspaper reporter.
Yeah.
It's more art than science, a lot of it. But for example, the series that my colleague Jessica Silva-Greenberg and Rob Gebeloff did on arbitration in 2015. We spent, and Jessica in particular, spent almost an entire year looking at how people unknowingly, average people have signed away their right to use the court system if they have a problem with a company, a school, by signing clauses that say instead of suing, if you have a problem, you must go to private arbitration. Which the process we learned favors, unsurprisingly, corporations all day long. That series was born out of a story that led us to that world, but more broadly, it was one of these things that, and these are these stories that I think are really the best ones. It was hiding in plain sight. I mean, when we really. And yet nobody had written about it in a big way. I mean, when we looked at it, arbitration clauses are everywhere. In fact, that was sort of one of the headlines of the first story, arbitration everywhere. And it's true. I mean, it's in your Netflix account. It's when you rent a car. Mm-hmm. It's when you put your mother into the nursing home. It's when you sign your kid up for preschool. And so it affected everybody. And it affected them in ways they didn't even know what they had given up. And so that, for us, that's when you know you've got something you can spend a year on and it's worth doing.
So, I mean, part of journalism is informing the public. But even if you're a consumer and you're aware of some of the pernicious features of these clauses, what can you do about it? If you're putting a loved one in a nursing home, you've got to put them in a nursing home. Is there anything that consumers can do to protect themselves in these cases?
Yeah, this was one of those ones that it was frankly shocking how powerless it made your average person, largely because of two Supreme Court rulings in 2011 and 2013 that essentially enshrined these clauses as the law of the land. If they stick it in a contract, no matter if it's buried on page 26, you sign that contract, it was on you to read that fine print and understand that was in there. So as much as judges, lower court judges, wanted to overturn these things because they were so unfair on a lot of levels. And we had a case of a son who was suing a nursing home because his mother had been murdered by her roommate. This is actually over in South Dartmouth, Mass. Mm-hmm. It's still stuck, the arbitration clause stuck. Yeah, judges are bound by those Supreme Court rulings that these arbitration clauses stick. So there really was nothing to do about it except the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the new agency created under the Obama administration, basically to address these kind of unfair things. It has put forward a new rule that would limit going forward the use of arbitration clauses in a lot of financial contracts. The future of that rule is uncertain now, given this change in administration, but at least they were trying.
Just talk a little bit more about that nursing home case, because you used what I would say is the right word, shocking. This was an elderly woman who was murdered, essentially, by her roommate. And it went to arbitration as opposed to a court of law or law enforcement.
Or a civil suit.
Or a civil suit. I mean, was this like the Soviet Union? No. But how can this possibly happen?
It's amazing. But what basically the courts ruled was, you know, when this woman checked in, it was right there in plain sight in her, I mean, plain sight. It was whatever.
Like, buried in 40,000 pages of fine print.
Precisely. That if you have a dispute with this, you know, facility, you have to go to private arbitration.
Wow.
And nursing homes were a especially troubling area because, I mean, think of the usual circumstances that you sign a parent in,
right,
who are desperate to get them in somewhere. You are, usually it's a pretty emotionally distraught move.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're the kid or the son or the daughter that's signing your parents in, the patient themselves may not have all of their mental faculties available. So it, on a lot of levels, it was quite troubling. In the waning days of the Obama administration, there was a ruling an executive order that addressed this very issue of arbitration in nursing home contracts that said if a home is going to accept any federal funding from Medicaid or Medicare, it could not have arbitration in its contracts. Again, the status of that rule is sort of in doubt now that there's been this change. So we'll see.
So I'm curious, as a journalist, when you look at these stories, are you, not that you're an activist, you're a journalist, but are you mindful of trying to achieve some good from retelling these heartbreaking stories?
Yes, I think the highest honor that you can have when your stories do have impact. I have a great privilege of working at a big paper like the New York Times that has a lot of reach and has a lot of impact. When you can make a difference, if a law should get changed, that is, you know, a wonderful thing and outcome of your work. But even something short of that, and I think all reporters and journalists feel this way, I mean, just simply giving voice to somebody and their story and their, you know, hardship, I think is a great victory in itself, because these are people whose voices aren't often heard. And to give them a platform, like a front page newspaper story, and to put them out there, that's a great honor and a great thing to be able to do.
One of the best read stories at the end of last year in the New York Times, and probably in general in newspapers, was one that you co-authored, and it was called How the Twinkie Made the Super Rich Even Richer. I even love the headline, by the way. I don't know if you wrote
Twinkie.
It or not. when you get Twinkie and Super Rich in a headline, that's
helps.
A score. Just walk us through that, how you got onto that, what it was for those people who may not have seen it or know about it.
That story came as part of a series that my colleague Ben Protess, who also covers finance at the New York Times, was heading up about private equity and how private equity basically was kind of taking over our lives in ways that sometimes we didn't recognize. And private equity is, you know, this is Wilbur Ross, this is, you know, these are the richest of the rich, highly successful investors, great track record, you know, amazing investment returns. So he did a series that looked at all these different aspects. The aspect we looked at was looking at how much money these guys make. And they are, you know, by a measure, the best paid people in the world, certainly in the country, if not the world. I mean, higher than Steve Jobs, higher than Mark Zuckerberg. They're not worth more, but they're being paid more. And that's an amazing thing when you look at what they do for a living. And we use Twinkies to show that.
Yeah.
This was an investment in a junk food company that had gone through enormous labor strife in 2012. Its former owners had fired everybody, all 19,000 workers, and these two private equity firms, Apollo Global Management and Metropolis & Co., bought it, the company and its assets, out of bankruptcy and resurrected it. They did it, what had been 8,000 workers making Twinkies, they did it with 1,400, and their original investment of about, in cash, of about $170 million, they, you know, returned 13 times in 3 years.
Wow.
It's astounding, but we, you know, kind of dug into exactly how they did it, and we contrasted the fortunes that were made with the experiences of the workers. And I think, you know, it came, we didn't sort of expect this at the time. It was something that we had worked on for a couple months, but it coincided with the Trump election. And lo and behold, when we called a lot of these workers back that we had been talking to for months, you know, almost to a person, they all voted for Trump. These are the people that had been laid off in 2012, who had been hired back by the company, but at lower wages. They were the angry Trump voter, and many of them were former union folks, dyed-in-the-wool Democrats that were just fed up with basically what happened at Twinkies.
We're going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. We're produced each week by the professionals at Rhode Island PBS. An audio version of this program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM satellite radios, channel 124, the POTUS channel. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. You can tweet me at JM Lutis. On my right is my co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal, and you can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week, he tweets at mcorkery5, is Michael Corkery. Michael. I'm curious, so you did another story, Miss a Payment, where the editors called one of the people in this article the virtual repo man, who's literally disabling technology remotely. First of all, how do you find a story like that? And how do you get someone like that to actually talk to you?
Yes, that was, right, that was one of the stories we did a couple years ago as part of a look at subprime auto lending. So mortgages were over, like, you know, the banks learned their lesson. They're not going to lend to people who can't afford to pay back their loans on their houses. So our next great idea is we're going to lend to those same people so that they can buy cars. Now, the great thing about
wow.
The great thing about cars is even more so than houses, the financial world figured out, is people need their car a lot more than they need a house because you need to get to work.
Yeah.
So you're going to do everything you can to pay back your loan. And if you're really desperate, and we really think even with that, you're such a risk, we the lender, we're going to take some extra precautions and we're going to turn to technology, in this case Silicon Valley, to help us. And so what they have done is they've come up with a series of devices which they install as a condition of your loan into your car, wherein if you are late a couple days, week on your loan payment, we're going to, from our office somewhere else in the country, we're going to disable the ignition to your car. So when you go out in the morning to start it, to drive your kids to the doctor, to get them to school, it's not going to be able to start.
That's wicked.
Until
that's fiendish. I mean, that's like medieval torture of some kind.
But it's like corporate Big Brother, right?
It is very much corporate Big Brother, 100%. They will say that the financial lenders will say, without this device, we wouldn't give these people loans, and then they wouldn't have a car, and then they wouldn't be able to get to work. Mind you, on top of this device, they're also charging them 30% interest on their loan.
Well, that's right.
So you're referring to the virtual repo man. Another device that is also installed alongside the disabler is a GPS.
Yeah. So they know where to go pick it up.
Right. So if they need to repossess it, they know exactly where it is. But what that allows is the loan officer at the little credit union, in this case it was a loan officer in Louisiana, who was able to look on his iPhone, like from his couch, and find out where all his cars were. But just like, think about that, like that some guy who gave you a loan gets to know, like, where you're going to dinner, yeah, where you're, if you're going to the doctor.
It's truly Orwellian.
But this is my question. What, so if the federal government was doing that, right, if this was a government chip that was implanted in cars, there would be protests in the streets, oh, right? We'd be marching on the Capitol.
Absolutely.
Why are American consumers so willing to accept the sort of the private sector's intrusion into our privacy, into, you know, I click those same arbitration agreements on Netflix because you've got to do it to get the account. But why are consumers so willing to tolerate this kind of behavior from corporations that they would never, never consider appropriate by their government?
Very good question. Because they don't have a choice. They really don't have a choice. Because if you decide, you know what, I don't like this Netflix thing, I'm against it. Mm-hmm. Not going to sign it. Netflix is, okay, sorry, can't get your streaming. Yeah. Your kids are out of luck. They want to watch, you know, Sleeping Beauty tonight. Sorry, you're out of luck. And they know that. They've got basically a lock. Mm-hmm. With these people, this is their only chance to get a loan. You either sign up for this unbelievable intrusion on your life, or you don't get to work, and then you're really out of luck. So that's how you get there. And
I have to tell you, I've lost the capacity to be shocked pretty much after all these years in journalism. When I read that story, I almost literally jumped out of my seat. I could not believe it. It was so far beyond the pale.
It's
a great amazing job.
No, well, it's that's a perfect example of where these people. There was one woman that we quoted who, you know, said that this was shut off on, like, while she was driving, and it shut the car down. Luckily, she wasn't hurt, but no one would believe her.
Right.
And we put this on the front page of the paper, and people believed her, and so much so that it. I have heard recently, as of a couple of weeks ago, because we did a bit of a follow-up, because the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is actually investigating these.
Oh, so you've got to react and good.
Subpoenaing some of these lenders. They've actually started pulling back on the use of some of these disablers because it's just, I think, because of the public relations and liability part of it.
That was a dramatic story, and I use that word in a complimentary fashion. But a lot of the work that you do that goes into that story and other stories involves spending a lot of time going through what I would call very obscure regulations, laws. How do you get the patience to do that? That kind of stuff requires just time and time and time and looking at documents and reading. And I mean, there must be hours that pass when you go, can I go home now? but it's a serious question.
It is.
How do you get the patience to do that? Because you need to do that.
Very much.
I'm not sure everyone has that kind of patience.
Very much. And some of my colleagues are even better at it. I mean, some of these, and, you know, Rob Gebeloff, who worked with Jessica and I on the arbitration series, is our computer-assisted database guy at the paper. And he, built this amazing database of arbitration decisions, which, because of a sort of fluky California law, you can, what is supposed to be secret, you can kind of get a sense of, you know, what the outcomes a lot of these arbitrations are. That patience that he has and I have to some extent for documents comes from a place of, I think, when you see the power of what data does, and by building a story that is so airtight because you have, you know, collected, whether it's based on court documents or it's based on, you know, obscure data that you can kind of pull and scrape and analyze, it just makes the stories that much stronger and that much more bulletproof and that much more, you know, a service, because this is something that, you know, again, it's resource intensive. It costs the paper an enormous amount of money to spend the resources to do this, but it's very worth it in the end.
So this is a big question. We probably should have started the show with it. But so you talk about all of the data that you use in your reporting, making it bulletproof. We're working in an environment now where the President of the United States is referred to, we mentioned this flippantly, but he's referred to the press as the enemies of the people. He has singled out the New York Times, among a couple of other handful of really sort of elite news gathering outlets. He has branded a lot of this fake news. As a journalist who has worked in building real credible bulletproof stories, how does that affect the work that you do? Or does it, I guess, is the question.
They're extraordinary statements considering where they're coming from, but I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when anybody starts blaming the messenger, like 1 month into the job, I mean, it's hard to take that seriously, and it makes you question it even further. I mean, this statement, I think the Times has written about this, that phrase, enemy of the people, has very scary historic.
Very scary history.
Precedent, but the substance of it and what it'll mean for journalism, I mean, I think it's only, you know, empowered certainly me and others at the Times. Our subscriptions are up.
I was going to say, in fact, it's had the sort of the perhaps the opposite.
Up. I mean, not just up, they're way up.
Yeah.
Big time up.
Yeah, it's had the opposite effect. So, again, it seems like it's part of the MO of a lot of sideshows and a lot of sort of, you know, inflammatory statements.
Do you ever occasionally step back from all this and think about the wisdom of the founders in writing the First Amendment? They made it first, not second.
And you've got about 27 seconds to answer that question.
We do this every
time. We got First Amendment, you got 27
now we're down
seconds.
To 20 seconds.
It's, listen, I mean, I think anybody in our line of work today that's involved in somehow trying to bring more understanding to the world and trying to root out the truth sees the power of that now more than ever. But yeah, you're right. It is the first, and it's, just all this turmoil notwithstanding, I think like it's going to stay that way.
I think we feel like we've really just touched the tip of the iceberg here.
We have really just touched it.
Michael Corkery, thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time today, but if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or visit us online at pellcenter.org. For Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Storing the Public Square.